50 pounds underweight, and it's like I came in, I had this rice bowl, this empty rice bowl, you know, and I just came around begging, and I was taking, you know, and trying to fill up my rice bowl, and my first sponsor said, you can't, you know, quit, you know, sharing the meetings, quit doing, you don't have anything to give anybody, you don't have anything to feed anybody with out of your rice bowl, you know, so I went around with this rice bowl, just kind of begging and taking whatever I could, and after a while, I started, you know, taking the suggestions and working the steps under a close supervision of a sponsor and developing a relationship with a higher power by taking the suggestions under the close supervision of a sponsor. And I started to fill up my rice bowl, you know. And then, you know, miracle of miracles, I stayed sober a day at a time. My rice bowl started getting full and overflowing. So then I started to feed people out of my rice bowl, you know. And the person who's about to speak tonight, her rice bowl stays empty because she gives so much. So please help me in welcoming Heidi.
All right.
I'm Heidi. I'm alcoholic. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the group and Eric for having me here tonight to share with you my experience, strength, and hope. I appreciate the opportunity to serve. And anybody who's got a little rice, I'm kind of hungry. My bowl is empty. It's a good thing, though. My sobriety date is March 18th, 1987. What? You're going to get old, too? It's all right. For those of you that are new, I'm going to talk about some things that might seem absurd and a little foreign. And perhaps you're here tonight under duress. Maybe somebody's forcing you, a wife or a husband who's given you an ultimatum, or perhaps the courts have sent you here. Or, I don't know, maybe the lash of King Alcohol has whipped you into submission. Whatever brought you here, if you're thinking that maybe this doesn't work, I'm here to share with you that for this alcoholic and for alcoholics just like me all around the world, it does. And it's interesting, you know, my dear friend Eric, I'm having a much better day today because he didn't use today. And if you look around this room, and I don't know how many people are here, 30 or 40 or maybe a little more than that, I'll bet for each one of these people that didn't drink today, there's at least three people in their life that are having a much better day. Arresting officers, mothers, wives, husbands, children. So if you think about how that grows exponentially with every single AA meeting that's happening right now, just in the Orlando area, think about the depth and width of that. Okay, so now let's talk about the flip side. What if every sober alcoholic on the planet drank tonight? What do you think this world would look like? Be a damn plague, right? So, in my experience of it, and what I'm trying to share with you if you're new, is that this works, it really does, and it has changed the world. And you can be a part of it right now, and all you have to do is choose it. If you didn't drink today, you have a chance. You have a chance. No matter how far down the scale you have gone, you have a chance to be a part of this world-changing, altruistic movement. That's exciting, right? I mean, look around. This is a good-looking group of people. I don't know if you've been at the local watering hole lately, but it doesn't look so good. So, let me tell you a little bit about myself. I hate this part. I'm going to tell you where I come from, how I got here, and how I stay here. And this is an open meeting, although it's Alcoholics Anonymous. Part of my story includes the use of some dry goods, condiments, mixed drinks. And that's how I will refer to those condiments throughout my story. Just as an element of respect for those who get uncomfortable when you say things like drugs at an AA meeting. I was born in a town called Streto in north central Italy, and my family came to the United States when I was about 9 years old. I became a naturalized citizen at 12. I was brought up in an atmosphere of extremes, extreme affection and unity, and extreme betrayal and brutality. And those mixed messages affected the way that I interact with the world even today, after having worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous for several one days at a time. So when I talk about my story, I include some incidents that occurred within the faith that I was brought up in. And I want to make it clear that I believe that the people who affected me, who were practicing that faith, were doing the best they could with what they had. They believed in what they believed. This is not an indictment of any church or any religion. I do not wish to engage in any controversy. I don't endorse or oppose any outside anything. When I was about 6 years old, me and Joey Capabianca and David Alferi were called to the Mother Superior's office at the parochial school that I was going to, which was about 17 miles from the Vatican. And if there are any people here that have ever practiced Roman Catholicism, that's about as Catholic as it gets. And so, you know, I'm a little kid, right? And the Mother Superior has like the bat phone to God or something, right? I go into this room with these two other little kids, and our families are there, and my mother's crying, and my father's vein in the middle of his forehead is about to pop out, and I don't know what I did. Well, the Mother Superior informed my family and the other families that were present that the three children in the room were children of the devil, acting out on deviant behavior because we wrote with our left hand. And that these demons needed to be extricated, and we needed to be searched, and our heads needed to be shaved so that they could check to make sure that we were not the child of the devil, which would have been cooler, right? So at six, I wasn't even playing for the same team as you folks. Innately evil, child of the devil. That's an interesting thing to embed in the mind of a six-year-old. And truth of the matter is, in looking back, I believe that they believed. I don't think they wanted to harm these three children. I think they wanted to save us. I believe that. It just so happens that their method ended up affecting me greatly in a way that perhaps had a few, one or two, negative outcomes. So, operating on the idea that I'm a child of the devil and moving to a new country seemed like a great way to begin the path of an active alcoholic. Just before we left Italy, my family was at a gathering at a restaurant. Family was, especially our extended family, is large, and we engaged in activities together quite often. And remember now, I'm a little kid, and as we were coming out of the restaurant, I was holding my uncle's hand, and we were walking toward the vehicle, and a man came up behind him and shot him in the back of the head. And as a little kid, that's a very... Right on, girl. That's a good one. Download that for me, would you? Okay. Anyways, as a little kid, that had another effect on my idea of security, which any of you who have worked the steps perhaps have had some experience with, how when our security is somehow threatened, we occasionally act inappropriately in our act of alcoholism. And sometimes in our act of sobriety. So we're on our way to the U.S., and everything is going to be all better because things got crazy in the mother country. And I started school, and I was smarter than everybody because, I'm sorry, but European educations. So I skipped a grade, and I began to realize that the neighborhood that I was being brought up in was full of a group of people that were very different from me. And you have to remember that, you know, this is in the late 1960s, early 1970s in the United States. A lot of crazy stuff was going on. And we were in a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant neighborhood, and we were very ethnic back then. And we weren't welcome. I know it's hard to believe. However, it was happening. And I remember being outside a church playing with this little girl, and, you know, I just started to sort of ease into this whole new lifestyle. I just started to feel secure again, and her mother came running out of the church at us, and we were both like, "What?" and snatched her up and said, "I told you not to play with that little greasy guinea. You're going to get olive oil all over you." I didn't know what guinea meant. Frankly, I just learned how to speak English. I wasn't sure if I was greasy or not, but I didn't know that I was really upset about that. Olive oil is a good thing. Try it. But I did ask my mother about it, and she explained what prejudice was, and she explained what racism was, and I started paying attention to the world around me because of that. And I was in church school, CCD, and I had, as a kid, what most people would have diagnosed as ADD or OCD or what. I couldn't sit still. And I come from an era where families used to sit down maybe once or twice a week and watch a television program together, and then they would shut the TV off. I know. Yeah, once or twice a week, you sit down with the family, you watch a television program, and then you move around. It's drastic. Nobody had a computer or a phone. You went outside in the evening. Yeah, don't worry, those days are over. So it used to drive my father crazy because all he wanted to do was watch the Jackie Gleason show, and I could not sit still. But if they gave me a book to read, then if I was multitasking, then I could make it happen to actually sit still and pay attention and not make that same vein in my father's forehead pop out. So I started reading encyclopedias and things of that nature, and I was in CCD, and we were talking about Catholicism, actually. And I was told that I should go home that night and get on my knees and pray and be thankful that I was born into a Catholic family because we were the only ones going to heaven, except for the 11,000 Jews mentioned in the book of Isaiah or whatever. And I had just read this thing in this encyclopedia about Buddhist monks and how sometimes these children were plucked from their village at age 5 or 6 and taken to the monastery and raised in the Buddhist system of belief and spent their entire lives in service to that system of belief. And I asked the nun who was presiding over that class if that Buddhist monk was going to go to hell, and she said, "Unfortunately, yes, and you should pray for his soul as well." And I said, "Well, that's separatism." And I remember late 1960s, early 70s, that was the kind of term that was being thrown around a lot, and I was asked, not gently, to not just leave the classroom, but I was excommunicated from that class, and that was the second of three times that I was kicked out of church school, which I'm not even going to go into. But anyways, I felt as though my faith had abandoned me more times than once by this time. And because I was a child of the devil, I never felt like I fit in anywhere, not even with my family of origin. So operating on that excellent emotional foreground, I went out into the world, and by the time I was in my early 20s, I was I was addicted to alcohol and other substances, and my life was becoming incredibly unmanageable on the inside and the outside. And I do art for a living. I've always done art for a living. And the kind of art that I was doing at the time that I'm about to mention was very lucrative. And I only had to work about 3 weeks in a row, and then I'd be off for 2 or 3 months, and then I could work for another 4 or 5 weeks in a row and make a bunch of money and do whatever I wanted to do the rest of the time. And what I really wanted to do, basically, was to check out. And got to the point where the job that I was working when I wasn't working became more important than the job that I had been working. And it seemed more prudent that if I was going to be indulging in some substances, that rather, I just wanted to cut out the middleman, man. You know what I mean? I figured out, why am I buying these dry goods from you? I can open up my own dry goods store and cut you right out of the center. And so I did that for a little while, and I got myself into just a little bit of trouble. And, yeah. So this is my new job, and I was enlisted by a family member to come down here to the south and pick up some dry goods and bring them on home. And I didn't realize, see, I knew I had a little bit of condiments in my car, but this family member had gone ahead and very generously loaded up the rest of that car with an even larger amount of dry goods, and of course I got pulled over on the way home, and I was arrested and consequently convicted and spent about 18 months in Muncie State Correctional Facility for Women for dealing in dry goods. Seemed outrageous to me, but that was where my disease took me. Now, you would think that would be a little bit of a wake-up call, but, you know, you can't scare an alcoholic. And that certainly didn't scare me. I became accustomed to it, unfortunately. So I opened up shop again, like any good business owner. And I was having a little argument with another shop owner at one point in the Hill District in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He was trying to activate a hostile takeover of my company. And I was not going to have that. So, you know, it's never like the movies when you get into some kind of physical confrontation with one freaking drunk with another freaking drunk. It's always just messy and sloppy and ugly, and it never looks cool, like that Steven Seagal or something. He's not even sweating, you know. But in real life, it's ugly. And we had worked our way out into the stoop. Anybody's from the Northeast, you know what a stoop is? Worked our way out into the stoop, and he had overpowered me, much to my chagrin, and I was on my back on the ground. And because he couldn't get what he really wanted from me, what he had decided is that he was going to stab me to death. And what I remember most from this stabbing is that I didn't actually feel the incision. What I felt was the tug. Tug. And just as I was about to be almost cut in half, this gentleman who was towering over me, I hear this, donk. He sits up straight like this. And then just like a tree, man, it was crazy, like a movie, just woo. And this woman's face appears just where his face had been. And she looks at him and she says, "Not today, motherfucker." Excuse my profanity. So, you know, we're trying to decide what to do with me because my guts are hanging out. And it's January and we're about 8 blocks from a hospital, and she's drunk and I'm drunk, and I'm like, yeah, you can't take me. It was a cluster rupture. So I walked 8 blocks holding my intestines in And I knew that it was getting a little bit dangerous because my blood had gone black. I'd seen in a movie somewhere that that means you're about to bleed to death or something. It seemed a little disconcerting at the time. However, I did make it to the emergency room, and I did survive that. And that was in January. And they told me that one of the reasons that I survived is because it was like Pittsburgh in January. It's like 44 below out or something. My nostrils were frozen when I got there. So that was an interesting piece of my life that I hope I never forget. However, you know, I'm out of the hospital for 2 or 3 weeks, and I'm thinking, it's just a flesh wound. It's not that big of a deal. I think I could probably open up shop again, just like a good business owner. So I decided to scale down, just have a little neighborhood store. Less problems to deal with. And in the interim, I did a lot of drinking. I drank every day. I drank every day, no matter what, from the time I was about 12 years old until I got sober. And yeah. So I'm at an Irish pub downtown Pittsburgh called Mitchell's. It's directly across the street from the number one police station. And I'm drinking. And I'm Italian. And it's March 17th. And they're drinking green beer. And I'm getting ugly drunk. And there's this big Irish guy sitting next to me talking about how great Irish people are. And I'm like, you know what, buddy? The only reason there even is a St. Patrick's Day, which, by the way, St. Patrick, St. Di Pasquale, is actually Italian, not Irish, is because you Irish pigs can't make it all the way through Lent. You got to have a day in between to eat and drink and be freaking merry. So demure. Anyways. So he takes issue with what I have to say, and I said something about his mama eating too many potatoes, and the next thing I knew, he was shoving me. I didn't like it when people put their hands on me, so I knew what to do. See, I had two brothers growing up. And so I punched him right in his throat, and I watched him gasp for air and slide down that bar stool onto the ground, and as he was on his way down, I did let him know that I had not actually broken his larynx or his esophagus, and that if he didn't calm down, he was never going to get his air back. And if he passed out, all of his muscles would relax. And if he hadn't used the potty recently, his bladder muscles would go ahead and go as well. So he might better just relax and try to take a breath. Well, he didn't think that was cute. So I walked away, and I'm thinking, you know, it's a no-win situation for this man. If he gets up and he beats me up, he beat up a girl. If he gets up and I beat him up, he got beat up by a girl. I can't lose, right? So I go back over to my green beer, and I decide I'm going to go ahead and finish that up, and he comes barreling over to me and empties my purse on to the bar and takes out his badge. My friend Michael calls that leading with the chin. So here I was in front of the same magistrate I'd been in front of about 10 million times, and she said, you know, I don't think you're a bad person. I think you're sick. I think you have a drug and alcohol problem. And I'm like, I'm sick. I'm sick? The police will not leave me alone. I'm sick. This guy is sick. I'm not sick, okay? I'm not sick. She said, okay, either you're sick and you're going to Gateway Rehabilitation Center, or he's sick and you're going to Muncie State Correctional Facility for Women. I went, whew! I'm not feeling very well, Judge. I might be sick. So, yeah. I did very well at that particular rehab center. It was a 28-day program. I made it 27 days. And I was, yeah, right? Same you too, right? So I had an individual therapy session with a really good therapist. I mean, he was really good. And he was just telling me way, way more truth than I wanted to hear. And he kept telling me the truth, and I kept asking him to be quiet. And he told me a little more truth, and I asked him to be quiet. And he told me a little more truth, and I told him to shut up. And then one more little piece of truth, and I came across that desk, and I grabbed him by his throat, and I said, shut up. Well, he quit talking. And they asked me to leave. And by some miracle, I didn't get violated, and I had a friend, and I knew that she had gotten cleaned up a little bit, and I was at my wit's end. I did not want to go back to jail. I was tired. And so she took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a church basement meeting. A lot of times up north, that's where meetings are held, or in the basement of churches, which, you know, we roll up on a Catholic church, I'm like, but I was desperate. I was even willing to go inside the enemy's house in order to get some help. And it was a big meeting. It was back when people smoked. Everybody smoked every damn where back then. And I was wearing my best hate face and my combat boots and my mohawk, my Metallica t-shirt. I was looking fine. And, yeah. So I'm there only because I don't want to go to jail again. And it was a huge meeting, very smoky. All I heard was blah, 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 God. Blah, blah, God. Blah, 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 God. And I was convinced this was not the place for me. And they did the chips thing at the end of the meeting. And I did notice that some people were speaking my language. I did, a few things did slip through that facade of tough guy. And so this woman gets up to do the chips, and she's from the Midwest, and she's a big lady, and she's got that big hair that arrives like 10 minutes before you do. Remember, it's the 80s, right? This great big hair and these big rosy cheeks look like somebody cut an apple in half and shoved it onto her face. She's up there all happy and sober and giving out chips, and comes to that one day, 24 hour, want to change your life chip, and my friends are kicking me out of the chair, get up there and get your chip, and I walk up with my best hate face on, and this woman's name was Debbie, and she picked me up in that great big Midwestern mama hug, and she whispered in my ear, welcome home, welcome home. 23 years later, I remember what that felt like. Because I'd never really felt it before. And that's why I came back. It's because of her. Because of that moment, I for once felt like I fit. And I knew something was going on at this meeting. So I kept coming back, and I got a sponsor who had a sponsor who had worked the steps, and I didn't drink a day at a time, and I stayed away from people, places, and things, and I opened up my mind to the idea of a power greater than me, even if that was just good orderly direction or a group of drunks. And by the grace of God, I stayed sober for a little bit, and I'd chosen a sponsor who was just like me. She was a little Italian girl. She was angry. She operated in rage and fear pretty much all of the time, and she hated everybody, including herself, and I loved her. So she taught me a lot about her higher power and about how to conduct myself in a meeting, and she took me through the steps and led me to that first spiritual awakening. I will forever be grateful for that. And after she had done so, she suggested that I start to sponsor other women, and I did. There was a young woman that I was sponsoring, and one afternoon she called me in a tiz. She was telling me a little bit about something that was happening in her life and asked me how to apply the steps to it. And I decided that I would share with her a piece of my story. And when I did start to tell her a piece of my story, she finished that story for me. Now, I had only told one other person that story, and that was my sponsor during my fifth step conversation. It was one of those stories that I was going to take to the grave with me. And this little girl I barely knew reiterated my story. I said, "Where'd you hear that?" Because in my mind I'm thinking, "God, please, no, don't let it be true, don't let it be true." Maybe she knew she was going through this and she just told her the story to try to help her. And she said, "Oh, Kitty was at my house with my mom and a group of folks playing poker, and she told us a little bit about your story for a few laughs." So I hung up the phone, and I immediately started making plans to kill her dog, because she loved that dog. And I was, needless to say, beside myself. And I decided that before I went on a murdering spree of some four-legged, lovely little creature, that I would call a friend in AA. Because I needed a driver, right? So I called my friend Tracy. Tracy was one of those women in AA that worked my last nerve. However, she was a great AA, extraordinary AA, and she came over and she babysat me that day, and she ran me all around town. She said, "Yeah, we're going to go kill the dog in a minute, but I got to go over here to Walmart. I got to get this and I got to get that." By the end of the day, I'm exhausted because I've been to every discount store in Pittsburgh. And she says, "Are you sure you want to kill that dog?" And I said, "No." And she started to share a little bit of her experience, strength, and hope with me. And the next thing I knew, she was helping me work those steps and applying that to how I felt about this woman who had shared my story at a card game. And what became clear to me from God through her is that this was an alcoholic just like me, doing the best she could with what she had. And for me to judge her because she had acted out on one of her character defects was something that we don't do in AA. She wasn't doing anything to me. She was doing something for herself. She wanted to fit in. She wanted to be loved, liked. How could I hate her for that? Now, I didn't want her to be my sponsor for another damn minute, but she helped me learn how to forgive, and she helped me learn how to have a comfortable space between me and another human being. And any time after that, it was clear to me, because of that experience, that any situation, any time I was fretted or vexed, I could use that simple set of spiritual principles to get okay, to get right. Recognize that I'm powerless and accept that idea. Understand that my life is unmanageable by me. I end up in jail and picking fights with big Irishmen on friggin' St. Patrick's Day. Insane for me to continue to do that. I know there's a power greater than me out there, because all of a sudden I don't even think about alcohol. That's proof to me. I don't even need to have faith. I'm going to write down whatever's still bothering me, and I'm going to see my part, and I'm going to share that with somebody. And by that time, I've probably gone through enough of the process to see what my character defect is, or what self-centered fear has led me to act out in such a way that has caused some kind of chaos in my life. And once that's been isolated, I can ask for God to remove that in God's time. And then, you know, I might have to take a look at who I may have harmed along the way and make a little list and do my best to make an amendment. And then I'll probably spot check inventory it for a few days, make sure that that same kind of shortcoming hasn't cropped up as a result of that character defect. And then I'll probably pray about it, sit still, and wait for the answers to come, and then put that right in my Rolodex so that I can go ahead and share that with another person, so that any discomfort that I went through, any pain that I may have gone through, will help me to be of service to my fellow AA, or just my fellow human being. So this woman who shared my story at her card game has inadvertently made me a better AA, made me a better person. However, there have been times throughout my sobriety where I have balked and become belligerent. And there was a time after this happened, this incident with the conversation, where I was disgruntled with AA and people in AA. And I'd gone to two meetings in a row talking about how I was done with this crap. I was going to just stay here long enough to get enough time under my belt that I knew I wasn't going to drink again any minute, and then I was out. This is all crap. All you people are full of you know what. And I'm using. Maybe I'll use. I don't care. I'm sick of this. I can't trust any of you. I can't trust me. What's the use? I'm miserable. I might as well drink. So, second meeting, I did this, and I'm standing outside, and I'm smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee. I think we should have a team. Cigarettes, smoking, and coffee drinking team for AA. We'd be champions. So I'm out there talking smack and saying, yeah, that's it. I'm leaving here. I'm going to go get drunk. And behind me, I hear these words. Not today, motherfucker. What? Restored my faith right then and there. For me, that was a God shot. That was the woman who saved my life that night on that stoop. And she was sober. And she was telling me, you are not drinking tonight. God works. This program works. It really does. So we shouldered up for a little bit, became very, very, very good friends, and she stayed sober for a very long time until she passed away as a direct result of this disease. But during the time that she was sober, we learned from each other, and we went to meetings endlessly, and we worked with other alcoholics endlessly. And when I first got sober and well into my 10th year, we did a lot of 12-step calls. We went out and got people. The treatment centers didn't bring them to meetings back then. You went and got them, and you dragged their asses in and just prayed to God they would stay. And if they didn't, that was okay. You stayed sober that day. And I try to continue to be of service today to the best of my present ability, and I hope that that ability will continue to grow if I maintain my spiritual condition. And I have found that to be true. That is my experience. If I maintain my spiritual condition, I am better capable of being of service to my fellow alcoholic as well as my fellow human being. So after all this craziness, I'm at a meeting, and I need a new sponsor, right? I didn't kill the dog, by the way. Don't call PETA on me. I did need a new sponsor, and I was still belligerent, but I decided I wasn't going to drink a day at a time, and I didn't really have the desire to drink anymore. I just acted like I did because I liked getting that attention. So I'm pissing and moaning at a meeting, and this great, big, beautiful black woman walks up to me after the meeting, and she says, "You hard-headed. What's your name?" I said, "Who the fuck are you?" She said, "Oh, I'm your new sponsor. That's who I am. This is my number. You call me tonight." And I did. I have no idea why. I didn't like her. She scared me a little bit. But I called her, and I developed such a wonderful relationship with this woman, and she taught me so much. I have been so blessed in sobriety with wonderful teachers and great sponsors and great friends, and she taught me how to let go and let God. She taught me attraction rather than promotion. She showed me the way of humility, the way of humble service to another. And I will forever be grateful for my interaction with this woman. She was able to reach me when really almost nobody was. And she convinced me through her lifestyle that this works. It really does. She used to say to me things like, "So are you talking to any newcomers this week, girlie?" Now, I'm not really talking to any newcomers, but I'll tell you what. I was in that noon meeting today, and that freaking girl with the red hair does not shut up. She's on my last nerve. I'd like to take her out back after the meeting and beat the living crap out of her. Is that included in reaching out to a newcomer? She said, oh, you're going to call her. I said, did you not just hear me? I want to smack her. You got me calling her. I think you might be her new sponsor. I sponsored Nancy with the red hair for about 8 years. She knew how to reach me, like I said, and I think that what you'll find if you're new, if you connect with a sponsor and you put your faith in their, if you put your faith in the program, what you'll find is that oftentimes, from God through them, miraculous things will occur between the two of you. For me, the God of my understanding lives in the breath between me and another alcoholic when we're sharing honestly with one another. So again, if you're new, stay away from people, places, and things. Go to a meeting. Go to another meeting the next day and don't drink between meetings. Ask whatever you believe or you don't believe in for some help. You don't have to take this second or third step all at once. You can take it piecemeal, a little bit at a time. If you're willing to be willing, I think that you'll find that the highway is broad and welcoming. And here in AA, we're not really concerned with what the God of your understanding is. It's really none of our business. I know it's none of my business. I don't really care. However, I think that you'll find that we will suggest that with this higher power that will contact you. You can seek a little bit, and that's a good idea. But if you find a sponsor and work the steps, the precise instructions that are in the book. And what you'll find is in the 12th step, you'll have a spiritual awakening. You don't even have to work at that God thing. It'll come naturally. And as you continue to apply the steps in your life, these behaviors that you have will naturally recede. It's almost like the idea that your disease and your sobriety have a hard time living in the same body. They at some point become mutually exclusive. And you'll learn how to manage that by coming to meetings and asking for help and doing the best that you can to be of service. At least that's been my experience. However, I had to quit drinking in order to get sober. God bless you and the horse you came in on. And if you can just not drink a day at a time, dream big. Program will provide you with miraculous results if you work it. And I am very, very grateful that I've had this opportunity, and I appreciate your attention. And I really hope that somewhere along the line we'll get to know each other a little bit. This is my home group. I'm here often. If you don't have a home group, this is a great home group. Consider making it yours. If you don't have a God of your understanding, you're welcome to pray to my God. God of my understanding doesn't have a face or a name or a gender, so you can call it whatever you want. I like Frank. It's a good name. It's a good, strong name. If you'd like to pray to Frank tonight, I would invite you to do so. Thank you again.